This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with the authors of the new book, The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals.
They jumped on the Ronald Reagan bandwagon back in the 1980s, and for them it was like organizing a demand for ice water in hell. They caught on to these conservative forces and they really changed the law.
We'll listen to acclaimed Pakistani writer and filmmaker Tariq Ali during the recent launch of his new book in New York.
Tariq's book is called The Stalinist Legacy, Its Impact on 20th Century World Politics.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, the news media has been obsessed, really, since the events at the Boston Marathon, and we haven't talked about it on Law and Disorder yet. What do you think the political repercussions are going to be?
I think they're gigantic, and I think they're all bad. What those two men did in Boston was despicable. One of the bad things I think is going to happen is there's going to be a renewed debate about the efficacy of capital punishment. They're going to want to execute this kid. Another piece of the rule of law that's going down is Miranda.
The Miranda exception, which we should remind listeners, it was at the Times Square bombing a couple of years ago that the Justice Department proclaimed there to be an exception to Miranda.
The public safety exception to Miranda. The Supreme Court decided in the middle 60s in a decision written by Chief Judge Earl Warren called the Miranda case that under the Fifth Amendment, suspects had certain rights. One of their rights was to remain silent. Another right was the right to an attorney. And that before police could interrogate them, they had to, what they call, Mirandize them. They had to give them their Miranda rights. The rule is that police have to say, you've got a right to remain silent, you've got a right to an attorney. And they have a little card, and they read from the card so that they can testify later in court that they read them the Miranda rights. Well, the government in the wake of 9/11 has come up with what they call the public safety exception to Miranda. So they now say that the police can interrogate somebody without giving them their Miranda rights. And in fact, what happened in Boston with the 19-year-old kid wounded in a hospital bed was that the cops came up and they came up with a judge, a magistrate. And the judge and the cops interrogated this kid without giving him his Miranda rights. That manipulation and fear is not going to result in any good. The founding fathers adopted the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, the right against self-incrimination, because they knew from European history that governments interrogate people, they torture people, they get confessions out of people, and then they convict them. And the Fifth Amendment was designed to avoid that. That people had the right to not have to testify against themselves. Now, as a consequence of the Boston bombing, the Miranda right is no longer a solid right. There's an exception to it. Will it grow? We'll see. But on a larger scale, what's going to happen as a consequence of the Boston bombings? Nothing good. I remember when Richard Nixon retired and a reporter asked him, what was the key to your success, President Nixon? And Nixon answered unhesitatingly. He said, it was fear. I learned how to use fear. And they don't teach you how to do that in the Boy Scouts. And that kind of level of fear has been jacked up tremendously since Boston. You had the streets of Boston filled with tanks and hundreds of soldiers looking for a teenager. You've got those constant announcements on the New York City subway about if you see something, say something. The level of fear has been jacked up, and that only reinforces the police state. They've militarized the police departments throughout the country. You now have police departments with armored personnel carriers. They've coordinated police departments and the federal government all over the country. The cover for doing this has been to fight the war on terror. But the real use of this militarization of the police force and the jacking up of the fear level is to use it against progressive forces fighting for social change. I'll give you an example. Occupy Wall Street started in New York, but it was copied all over the country, and there were occupation sites in many hundreds of cities around America. A lot of those sites were closed down by a coordinated effort of the federal and local government using the same tactics on the same night. You have that kind of coordination of repression now that we didn't have before 9/11. My fear is that it's going to be jacked up even more since the Boston terrorism. The other observation I had about the Boston terrorism incident is what Chalmers Johnson called blowback. His great book, Blowback. What is blowback? It's a CIA term. And it initially was invented by the CIA to talk about what happens, these unintended consequences of CIA action abroad. And it affects people abroad, and it has an effect here. And that's precisely what happened in Boston. We know from the interview with a 19-year-old that they did what they did because they were in solidarity with the Muslims who were bombed in Iraq and before that in Afghanistan. They did this despicable act to somehow respond to the American government's war in Iraq and in Afghanistan. The Iraq war was the supreme crime. There is evidence now that there were no weapons of mass destruction. It was a war of aggression. It's the supreme crime in the world under the Nuremberg laws. One of the consequences to us is that you have these two twisted individuals killing two people and a child and wounding another 160 in Boston. That's called blowback. That's a consequence of American foreign policy, and that's what we should be talking about. And fortunately, unlike after 9/11, when there was no discussion about why they did it, remember Bush said they did it because they're evil and they hate us because of our freedom, and then he told us all to go shopping. But now, hopefully, there'll be a discussion about blowback and about how this was done as a consequence of America destroying the society and culture in Iraq and doing the same thing to Afghanistan. So we welcome that discussion, but we condemn any sort of terrorism like this. It's a great crime. It's a great crime not only for the murders and wounding that it did, but politically it's a great crime because it tells people you don't have to do anything. You sit on the sidelines. You don't have to organize. We're going to take care of it. And secondly, it puts the onus of violence on these kids rather than on the United States government. And it's a government that Martin Luther King said is the greatest source of violence in the world. And that's where the onus of violence should be on, and not on these twisted individuals who committed this crime in Boston.
Well said, Michael.
Michael, we sorely miss our friend Lynn Stewart, who's in prison serving a really unjust 10-year sentence. And of course, as we've reminded our listeners over the last few weeks, Lynn is taken ill again, and there's a petition for her. And I know you want to talk about it and get as many people active, because we want to get Lynn out of prison on a compassionate release. So tell our listeners how they can help and what the situation is now for Lynn.
Well, we're going to link to how you can sign the petition. Lynn's got stage 4 cancer, as a lot of you know. That is her initial cancer, which was in remission when they put her in prison 3 years ago, is now in full bloom. It's spread to her bones. It's spread to her legs. It's spread to her lungs. It's spread to her lymph nodes. And it really is fatal. We all want to get her out and get her some better medical care than she can get. She's in a 7-person cell down in Fort Worth, Texas. Get her up to New York, better medical care, and be surrounded by her family and friends. And in order to do that, the Bureau of Prisons, the people with the key, have to make a motion to Judge Codal to ask that she be given a compassionate release. It's possible you can get that. They don't do it very often. But with all the friends and supporters that Lynn has, we're hopeful that we can accomplish that. 6,000 people have signed the petition so far. And if you'll grab a pencil, I'll give you the name and address of the director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, because a well-aimed letter at him is not going to hurt. His name is Charles E. Samuels, Jr., Federal Bureau of Prisons, 320 First Street Northwest, repeat, 320 First Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20534. Please send a letter, go to lawanddisorder.org, our website, sign the petition. We'll be updating you every week on how Lynn is doing. In their just-published book, The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals, former National Lawyers Guild President Michael Avery and attorney Danielle McLaughlin trace the history of the Federalist Society. It's a group that started in the 80s and has chapters in every major city and law school in the country. Its members include economic conservatives, social conservatives, Christian conservatives, and libertarians. They have 25,000 members. They have a budget of over $10 million a year. They get their money from right-wing charities like the Olin Foundation and the Koch brothers. And they've had a tremendous influence on the federal judiciary. There are four members of the Supreme Court who are in the Federalist Society. Half the people appointed by the last Bush to the federal courts are members of the Federalist Society. They've targeted human rights as against property rights, and they're on a roll. Civil rights attorney Michael Avery joins us to talk about his book. He's a professor at Suffolk University Law School. He's also joined by his co-author, attorney Danielle McLaughlin, who's a member of the Litigation and Dispute Resolution Group at a major law firm.
Welcome, Michael and Danielle, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Heidi.
Now, let's start by telling our listeners, what is the Federalist Society?
Well, the Federalist Society started in 1982. Law students began it. Now it's an organization of lawyers, judges, law students. And more than anything else, it's a conservative network that links together lawyers and other conservative activists who want to make change in the law and in public policy.
How did you two become interested in this topic?
Well, I got interested in it because I saw how much power and influence the Federalist Society had during the years that George W. Bush was president. And at the same time, I realized that most people don't know very much about them. They've really kind of remained under the radar outside of Washington, D.C. They've remained under the radar. So I thought it was important to tell their story.
You've written, Michael and Danielle, in an article recently that, and I'm going to quote it because I want to ask you about it, the dockets of the federal and state courts, including the Supreme Court, are brimming with test cases brought or defended by Federalist Society members to challenge government regulation of the economy, roll back affirmative action, invalidate laws providing access to the courts by aggrieved workers, consumers, and environmentalists, expand state support for religious institutions and programs, oppose marriage equality, increase statutory impediments to women's ability to obtain an abortion, and otherwise advance conservative ideas. So, you know, where do these guys come from?
You know, if I could answer that, I think there's sort of two broad issues there, Michael. The first is that the substantive areas of law that we're seeing these test cases brought in are very much reflective of the core values of the society, and those are notions of small government, especially in particular small federal government, the idea that the state exists to preserve freedom, and the idea that the United States should not be at all informed by jurisprudence from other parts of the world. The second piece of that is who is actually doing this work. And as Michael indicated, this is a large group, but the society itself as an organization does not do the work. Its members do. And many of them are involved in public interest law firms who do exactly this. They go out, they find plaintiffs, they challenge regulation at the state level, and in many cases have been successful in challenging laws in opposition to their worldview all the way up to the Supreme Court.
I'd like to talk specifically about the cases they've been involved in. Because every time you turn around, it seems they have another success. Citizens United, for example, I think all of our listeners will remember. You can talk about that. But let's give an overview of how they've been able to commit their reactionary policies to law.
Well, you know, it was interesting. They came along just at the right time for them. It really was kind of a perfect storm. You had Ronald Reagan in the White House. You had a general renaissance of conservative thought that was promoted by people like Bill Buckley in the National Review. You had resistance to school integration and forced busing. So there was a backlash kind of waiting to happen against some of the things that had happened in the law when Democrats were presidents and Earl Warren was the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. So when these young people graduated from law school, they immediately found jobs in the Reagan administration. And it's very important to recognize here the role that Ed Meese played First, he was counselor to the president. Then he was attorney general. Later, after he left government, he became the principal figure at the Heritage Society. And all along, over the last 30 years, Meese has opened doors for these young conservatives, who are now, of course, not so young. And as a result, they got jobs in government. They got clerkships with influential judges. They became judges themselves. They got jobs in the leading corporate law firms with Supreme Court practices. And they really, you know, worked this very large network that they developed.
Can you tell us a little bit about how they're funded? And I understand that you said the Federalist Society model has been so successful that other groups have used it. Can you talk a bit about that as well?
Absolutely. So the group had its earliest financial help from, among other sort of conservative philanthropists, the Olin Foundation. And Olin has been a long-standing supporter of the Federalist Society. Now, the key to the success of the funding of Olin has been in the sense that Olin grants were not tied to any specific short-term goals. So Olin basically said, we believe in your ideas. Here's some money, go out and build an institution. So the fledgling Federalist Society, and in fact the Federalist Society today, is not hamstrung or handicapped by having to report back or having to meet various short-term goals. The conservative funders believed in long-term institution buildings, and that was really the genius of the way that the money flowed from organizations such as Olin and others.
Danielle, talk about their influence. Where are they on law school campuses and cities and firms, in the judiciary, in the people who appoint and suggest judges? I mean, how widespread is this?
More widespread than most people think, and that was, as Michael said earlier, really part of the motivation for putting this work together. There are Federalist Society student groups on the campus of every single accredited and some unaccredited law schools. There are lawyers chapters in every single major city in the country and many other second and third tier cities. There are actually some Federalist Society affiliated groups outside the country, and we have, using the work of other political scientists, noted that I believe it's every single federal judge that was appointed during the George HW&W administrations was either approved by or a member of the society. So even though their numbers are, say, 45,000 strong, where they are is very influential.
Are there any members of the Supreme Court that are in the Federalist Society?
Oh, four members of the Supreme
and who
Court
are, they?
Are or have been members of the Federalist Society. Antonin Scalia was the advisor to the society, one of the advisors to the society at the University of Chicago when they first got started. Samuel Alito is a longtime member of the society. Thomas is a member of the society. Roberts says that he doesn't remember ever having been a member of the society, but the D.C. chapter listed him as part of their executive committee. And if you go on the Federalist Society website, there's a very impressive video tribute to the society from Chief Justice Robert, you know, on their website.
Danielle and Michael, you have in your appendix a list of Federalist Society members. How did you get those names?
Well, these, first of all, Heidi, they're not all necessarily members. We weren't able to confirm that they were members. So we say it's a list of members and close friends or allies of the society. And we compiled this list as a result of really painstaking work where we would observe who signed amicus briefs that were filed with the Federalist Society point of view, or who wrote articles in other journals with a Federalist Society point of view, who spoke at their meetings and so on. And then we would try to confirm in one way or another whether they were members or not. Many people, of course, are openly members of the Federalist Society. Others, not so much, but through a variety of sources, I think we're very confident that the people in that appendix either are members or are very close to the society, and sometimes I call that list of people the 100 most powerful people in the country, most of whom you never heard of.
You know, how many judges, for example, when Bush the Younger was president, how many judges that were appointed that were who were members of the Federal Society?
About half the judges that George W. Bush appointed to the Court of Appeals were actually members of the Federalist Society.
Wow.
And more important than that, there were people in the White House and in the Justice Department who were members of the Federalist Society who vetted every single appointment that he made. As Daniel mentioned, when his father was president, the same thing was true. At that point, C. Boyden Gray, who's now a member of the Board of Visitors of the Federalist Society, was White House counsel, and his principal aide was Lee Lieberman Otis, who was one of the founders of the Federalist Society, and they had the principal responsibility for selecting federal judges or for vetting federal judges for George H.W. Bush.
We're speaking, if listeners have just tuned in, to Danielle McLaughlin and Michael Avery, two longtime colleagues and friends who've written a very important book called The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals.
In the book, you focus a bit on government regulation of economic rights and private property. Can you talk a bit about how post-New Deal jurisprudence and what its relevance is to readers and our listeners?
You know, this is one of the areas that we go into in great detail, both in terms of legal doctrine and in terms of the history of the cases. Many people don't realize that ever since 1937, when the Supreme Court began approving New Deal legislation and other progressive legislation and discarded some of the judicial concepts that had stood in the way of that kind of legislation in the past, ever since then, conservatives have fought to get obstacles to regulation into the law in one way or another. So Danielle, for example, was principally responsible for research and writing our chapter about the takings clause, which is not a topic that most people give a lot of thought to, but which is crucially important because they began to use the takings clause as an argument against government regulation, starting with the argument that anytime the government regulates private property, in effect, it's a taking that requires compensation by the government. And now, one of the other principal ways they're doing it, and did during the presidency of George W. Bush, is through use of the preemption doctrine, arguing that federal law preempts state law. And in particular, they tried to argue that federal regulations, which are very weak in the area of consumer safety and drug regulation, for example, that those federal regulations preempted state tort suits. So if somebody was injured by a drug, they couldn't sue in state court. Their argument was because as long as the FDA had approved the drug, everything was fine. So this battle over whether the government is able to regulate private property has been one of the principal ideological battles of American constitutional law since the end of the 19th century. And what we wanted people to see is that it's ongoing, and here are people who are very aggressively pursuing their agenda in this area.
Well, Michael, as past president of the National Lawyers Guild, you well remember our founding principle was that we put human rights over property rights. And I guess you could say the Federalist Society puts property rights over human rights.
They argue that property rights are a sort of natural right that everybody's entitled to,
and, yeah.
I think most people in the Lawyers Guild would reject that idea.
Well, yeah, going all the way back to John Locke, it wasn't a good idea then or now. Let me ask you concretely, in terms of the various cases that the Federal Society have been influential in, what kind of losses have we suffered at their hands?
Well, I would say one that listeners will know well is Citizens United, and Michael, you mentioned that earlier. That was shepherded through the courts by a gentleman named James Bopp, who is very much high up in the election law and free speech practice groups of the Federalist Society. What many people don't know, and of course no case is the result of one man, is Bopp had waged a long-time war seeking to free up the speech rights of corporations. And he basically built on a 1976 case, a Supreme Court case that basically held that campaign spending was a form of free speech. And from there, we turn around and we're in the 21st century, and we have the court agreeing and basically saying, agreeing with Citizens United and saying that there truly is a free speech right there. Sebelius, which is the Obamacare case, perhaps Michael can speak more generally to this, but was also a case where we had many Federalist Society members opposing the constitutionality of Obamacare.
That's interesting because a lot of people who just read the front page of the newspaper think, oh, you know, Obama won that issue, And Obamacare was held constitutional, as it turns out, under the spending clause to the Constitution. But that's part of that ideological battle I talked about before, and the conservatives won a big victory in National Federation of Businesses against Sebelius, because the Supreme Court said that the health care reforms were unconstitutional under the Commerce Clause. That the Commerce Clause didn't give Congress the power to regulate that, and that was a major victory for them.
Well, another very clear example, and some of the listeners may be interested in, is that there have been Federalist Society members in the Supreme Court arguing every single major abortion case since 1992's Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And as we've seen, the long history of abortion jurisprudence, slowly but surely, the idea of a woman's right to choose has been chipped away at by conservatives. Not least by members of this group.
I wanted to ask you about one particular important concept in the Federalist Society ideology, and that's originalism. And I wanted to ask both of you about what does originalism mean in terms of the way they choose to interpret the Constitution?
Well, I think most people in the Federalist Society, although they have varying views about this, And I would at this point just interject that one of the aspects of their success is that they accommodate disagreements among conservatives and manage yet to work together. So they don't all think the same thing about originalism, but they incline toward the original meaning school, which is exemplified in the jurisprudence of Scalia, Justice Scalia, which is to say that we can go back and by looking at dictionaries and other historical sources and other writings from the time, we can figure out what the words actually meant to the 18th century people who drafted the Constitution, and we should give those words the same meaning today. And of course, that's opposed by people who take a different point of view and say that the framers chose to use words that were elastic, that were somewhat vague, that were capable of interpretation, precisely because they realized that later generations would have to interpret the Constitution so that it made sense in their own time.
That is such a biased and conservative view to go back to a society, an agricultural society of a couple hundred years ago, trying to conform how we live today to the rules back then, that it really is ridiculous just on its face.
You just touched on something that I think fits into our final question, which is what lesson can the Federalist Society impart to progressives? And Michael, you just mentioned that they're tolerant of different viewpoints within the society, within the conservative branch. And I know that liberals don't tend to be as tolerant of differing views. Has that been an impediment?
Well, yes. As a former president of the National Lawyers Guild, I was able to see that sometimes we didn't do ourselves any favors because we treated some of our friends as though they were enemies. People were so concerned about trying to find exactly the right political position on every issue that they were intolerant of others who disagreed with them about some points. In the Federalist Society, it's just the opposite. They have agreed to disagree, and they invite everybody into a big tent. They're not afraid of ideas. They're not afraid of debates. They have liberals come to their meetings and debate against them with their ideas. And I think liberals and progressives can learn a lot from that ideas are important politically, that to explore ideas, you can't be afraid of disagreement. And it's better to tolerate disagreement than it is to try to be 100% correct all the time.
Well, Michael and Danielle, if you can get me and Heidi into one of their meetings, we're ready. The book is The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals by Michael Avery and Danielle McLaughlin. It's an important book. You'll get a feel for what's happened to this country in the last 3.5 decades when you read it. So we very much hope that this book is widely read, and we thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
We bring you now a talk by Tariq Ali on his new book, Capitalism and Socialism in the 20th Century. Karl Marx's oft-quoted observation that history weighs like a nightmare on the brain of the living is so true. Even 20 years after the Soviet Union's collapse, activists are still confronted by the legacy of Stalinism. At the same time, capitalism has failed millions of working people in the United States and across the world. Please give a listen to Tariq Ali's speech launching his new book, The Stalinist Legacy, Its Impact on 20th Century World Politics.
I think sort of the basic thing to understand about the 20th century is that this was the first time in the history of the world that a revolution had been made in 1917 by political revolutionaries who had set out with the idea of making a socialist revolution. This wasn't accidental, like the English and French revolutions, bourgeois revolutions were. It's not that the English Puritans and the French Enlightenment revolutionaries set out with the idea we're going to make a bourgeois revolution, which will be complete the transition from feudalism to capitalism, and these are the institutions we'll set up, and we will then execute a tiny proportion of the aristocracy. No. They didn't set out like that. It happened. And it happened because there were movements, class forces, social forces from below, political struggles, social struggles in a congealed way, not like we know them now at the top. And these revolutions, including the revolution in Holland, were, if you like, uncoordinated and unthought-out revolutions. The Russian Revolution was the first revolution in the history of humanity which was totally thought out. And the Lenin, not very fashionable these days, said, this is what we are going to do. We may not be able, we may not succeed, but this is the attempt to create in, on a global scale, a power structure that will benefit not just Russians, but the entire world. And you know, if you look at the impact of that revolution, it had a completely international impact. It was like lightning. It created anti-colonial movements, it encouraged liberation movements, which were not even communist in any sense of the word, but excited by this event to challenge imperialism. And you know, the Bolsheviks did think, sometimes in sort of slightly crazy ways, but for instance, when they were told at a very early period in 1919, they thought, how are we going to stop these imperial powers which are participating in our country in waging a civil war? And Trotsky says to Lenin, why don't we hit them where it'll hurt them, at the heart of their empires? So they say, yes, that's a good idea. What are we going to do? So they ask, Trotsky finds out that there are only 36,000 actual English soldiers controlling India. So he's astonished when he finds out. He says, 36,000 white soldiers, that's all? And they say, yes. So he asks his generals and marshals to prepare an emergency plan for a Red Cavalry of 25,000 people recruited largely from Central Asia, which can go through Afghanistan into India, defeat the British Imperial Army, and declare Indian independence. That's how they thought. You know, I'm glad they didn't try it, because who knows where it might have led us. But the thinking was absolutely clear. Hit the capitalist powers at their weakest points. Now, the revolution as conceived, and here we have to be very clear, what was the entire leadership of the Marxist movement in Russia? On this, the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks were agreed that it was a backward country. A large bulk of the country was unorganized peasants, barely liberated from serfdom. the size of the working class was minuscule compared to the countries of Western Europe, especially Germany. So what they said, what are we going to do? And for a long time they said, it's not going to be possible. What transformed it was the First World War, because that First World War politicized the peasantry who were recruited as soldiers into the Imperial Army to go and fight. And the defeats they suffered radicalized them considerably. And it was the soldiers and workers, and for soldiers, read peasants in uniform, who effectively provided the base for the revolutionary movement that won. But despite this, the thinking of the entire Bolshevik leadership at that moment was that if the revolution doesn't take seed in Germany, we are sunk. There is no way we can build socialism in Russia. We do not have the industrial base to do it. We need German industry and the German working class to do it. And so every single thing was linked to the German Revolution. I mean, if you read the writings now, which I've been doing for other purposes, but if you read them now, it's a constant theme. If you look at the pamphlets at the time, Lenin wrote a pamphlet, so can the Bolsheviks retain state power? And so they pushed and pushed and pushed. Hungary fell for a short time to a communist uprising. There was an uprising in Munich, foolish, because this is what happens when you impose a certain element of voluntarism and conditions aren't right. The big leader of the Munich uprising, a communist, said to the leaders in Moscow, I don't think the timing is right, was told, go for it. The timing is never right, which is also not untrue. He went for it, and it failed. And he made one of the most moving speeches in communist history, in his trial, said, yeah, we lost. But you have to understand, he said to the court, we communists are dead people on leave. Our lives don't matter. We will carry on trying. You can execute me. And they executed him the following day. And then they tried it in Berlin, where Rosa Luxemburg was completely opposed to it, because she said, it is not right. We do not have a majority of workers with us. Many of them are still loyal to the German Social Democratic Party. It's an adventure, but the decision had been taken by the Spartacus Bund, and they went for it, and they lost. And in this process, we lost in Germany the most capable, intelligent, gifted leaders of the German working class. And you know, it's not totally inapposite to refer that this is what happens when you have revolutions, full stop, that the successful revolutionary country wants to push and push because they know they can't survive on their own. The French did it. They did it in a deformed way via Napoleon, but Napoleon said, unless we get Europe, they will surround and destroy the gains of the French Revolution. He was right on that, actually, completely right. And had he succeeded in destroying Tsarism, which he didn't, for reasons, you know, too long to discuss now, when he invaded Russia, the plan was to destroy Tsarism, initial plan, completely give rights to the peasants, give them the code Napoleon, and distribute the land. And then the aim was also to set up republics. So when you don't set up republics, but create little monarchies, it doesn't help either. But that was the plan. But forget the French Revolution. You come just in the modern world to the Cuban Revolution. I'm just saying that this is a weakness of successful revolutionary. The Cubans win in Cuba through a combination of circumstances. One is that the Americans were totally unprepared for this event on their doorstep, completely unprepared for it. And the revolution succeeds and they chuck out all the American companies. Then they realize, we're a tiny island, and we need other Latin American countries with us. And so what worked in Cuba, and even in Cuba it worked, by the way, worked in the sense of being successful and keeping the United States at bay. It worked because it was not simply the armed struggle groups, which were very important. There was a mass movement, the July the 26th movement, in the cities. They had urban organization. And so to use the Foucault theory that a small group of armed revolutionaries can trigger off a revolution anywhere, we did it in Cuba, and we can do... It's, you know, when you think back on it now, it's completely schematic. And they try it in Argentina, where you have a huge workers' movement, totally under the hegemony of Peronism, which is a mixed blessing, but it is a blessing because it actually gave the workers a lot of rights in Argentina. And to think you can climb, jump over the Argentinian workers' movement with the crazy idea of a FOCO in a very obscure part of the country on the Bolivian border, it was a disaster. And then, okay, so it's a disaster, you learn from it. And then you repeat that disaster a year later. Then, you know, I try and understand these things. It's not that these are very intelligent people. All over the Bolsheviks, of course, were the most gifted political leaders that Europe has produced. But the Cuban leadership wasn't stupid either, nor were the French before them. It's the arrogance in a way of success that success creates, partially, that you think you can do it. Because we've done it, and God, we didn't think we'd be able to do it. And if we've done it, you can do it. And the analysis of conditions, social conditions, relationship of social forces is never worked out. And the groups in these countries are so much in awe of the people who've succeeded that they go against their own better judgments and carry out the orders. Always a mistake to blindly carry out the orders of some parent group in some other country without thinking about the concrete conditions in your own country. Always a mistake. If the conditions are right, fine, great. But if they're not, and you know the result is in South America, again we lost in every single South American country incredibly gifted, courageous people. The same in Germany. And the people who killed Luxembourg and Liebknecht were the people then who brought the fascists to power. One shouldn't isolate these two processes. Very closely linked. But for me, the question, therefore, is, okay, the revolution has been defeated. It has not taken off in Europe, so the Russian Revolution is totally isolated. What do you do? That was the big debate which gripped Russia in the 1920s. And that is a debate which is still of importance to us today, not just as history, but to learn the lessons from that debate. That in these conditions, the one thing you never do is disenfranchise the people who make the revolution. And say, we know better. They are demoralized, it's true. They've had enough. They've suffered the First World War, in which millions died. They've suffered their own civil war, in which 22 foreign armies intervened on the side of the whites against them. The masses get exhausted, naturally. Look at Afghanistan today. They've been fighting now, the peasants in Afghanistan, since the Russians went in. And they haven't stopped fighting. I mean, it is amazing they still do it. But I know from talking to people that they just are now reaching their limits, saying after the Americans, we kick them out, we hope no one else intervenes because we don't think we'd be able to handle it. I was told this by an Afghan in Pakistan 6 months ago. So, when the masses are exhausted, you have to understand that it's a hiatus. The decision the Bolsheviks made, largely, I think, because the revolutions failed in Germany, was to completely become a sort of Iron Curtain. I hate that phrase, but a fortress state. And then you do the logic of what you have done before. Emergency, civil war, all other political formations banned. And once you ban all other political formations, it's one thing to say all the political formations who are helping the whites, like conservatives and the cadets, they can't be allowed legality because they've taken up arms against us. That's acceptable. But to ban all left organizations because they're not in your own party, it's a huge error. Huge error. And this error became institutionalized after the death of Lenin. He, to his credit, actually, I would advise those who haven't read it to read Lenin's last will and testament. It's a very moving document, just on a human level. Here is a leader paralyzed by a stroke in 1922, about to die, who looks at what has been created and is partially horrified. And in his letter, he actually apologizes to the Russian working class. He says that, I apologize, I'm sorry that I allowed this to happen, accepts responsibility. But that also indicates that had he been in full health, together with others, they might have been able to stem the rot. Because the rot that then takes place, once you ban all other parties, you then ban dissent in your own organizations. It's logical. So anyone who's trying to argue against the leadership is regarded as an enemy and driven out or killed in the case of the Stalinist takeover within that party. And then follow the purges and the trials. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is that Stalin killed more Bolsheviks and revolutionaries than the Tsar did. That's just a fact of history. That then creates further demoralization, and a dictatorship sets in, which is monstrous. And this dictatorship is then presented to the world as socialism. And many people look, millions and millions accept it. Small minorities don't, but they are small, tiny. But by and large, the world accepts it, and the world thinks this is the way things have to be if we're going to get socialism. And that was not the case. And this wretched institutional structure created by Stalinism then becomes the norm and the model for many liberation movements who are fighting against imperialism, because imperialism is the enemy, and they link any form of democracy with imperialism, saying, well, we were screwed up by democracies, Britain, France, the Germans, the Dutch, creating these huge empires were democracies. Why should we mimic that? So they completely equate democracy and imperialism. And therefore they go for the structure which also helps the local bourgeois elites, or the, you know, fighting for independence, but very much within a bourgeois nationalist framework, that, okay, this is the method we're going to create. So throughout Africa, the Cubans accept that model, I mean, admittedly under pressures, because they had no options left once there was no development in the rest of South America, but still a huge mistake in my opinion. And with that goes a monopoly of politics and a monopoly of information. And why that monopoly of politics and information is wrong is not for moral reasons, but for very practical reasons. That if you completely close down all debate and discussion in the country, then who the hell is going to tell you that you're wrong? Neither in Russia nor in Mao's China were they prepared to listen to people who said you're going wrong, because there was no institutional structure in which workers or peasants or intellectuals could express it. I'm not even now talking about alternative parties, though I'm in favor of them. I'm saying Soviet-style structures, workers' councils, peasants' councils, in which you have regular meetings attended by representatives from workers and peasants who say, hey guys, this idea of transforming everything into people's communes isn't working. We can't build a furnace in every backyard. Saying to Stalin, the industrialization process and the way you've pushed it through is not working. The result is mass famines and millions are dying. And if the revolution is going to produce effectively cannibalism in the Ukraine, well, we're not going along with it. I mean, no structures exist for that. And so, and then the term is invented, enemies of the people. But these are the people who are effectively wanting these changes. So, you know, for a variety of reasons, subjective and objective, that is what we were landed with. And as long as you had a strong workers' movement in Western Europe, these things could be argued still. But with the weaknesses of the workers' movement and sort of total bourgeois domination, actually, and I'm not exaggerating, I mean, living in Britain today is really depressing. I know it's not great here either, but but you know, in Britain, it's a sort of tiny country now, effectively a vassal state of the United States. Its culture wrecked. Its political parties in general agreement with each other. So the hegemony of the United States globally. I mean, economically, the States is sort of suffering, and it's weakened by rivalries. But politically, militarily, it remains very strong. So you have a Europe which has effectively been Americanized, not to put too fine a point on it. You know, Labour and Conservatives are very similar to Republican and Democrat parties. One has a few, you know, one has a layer of people who are people we could run into and have a drink with. Not go beyond that, but certainly we could do that. Germany is virtually the same. Look at Italy today. It's a complete mess. This is a country which produced the finest Marxist intellectuals in Western Europe. Gone, dead. The Communist Party self-destructed. They had no option. They moved to the right. The trade unions weak. Politically and organizationally. And of course, the basis on which this happened is neoliberalism, which, you know, is deindustrialization, which is we don't want a working class, strong working class. The destruction of the mining communities was not because they were convinced that this was at an end and we were going to have nuclear power or gas. It was not. It was to destroy the foundations of the English labor movement. And they are very open about it. Seamus Milne has written a very good book, The Enemy Within, which maps out how Thatcher actually destroyed the miners' communities, which is why many miners' community were actually celebrating when she died. I mean, you know, I'm not, it was a sort of, the only victory they had was her death. And In this situation, we have, as a result of all this, and by the way, the debates in this book, The Stalinist Legacy, are all about what I've been talking about. You know, with debates which erupted after the Stalinization of the Soviet Union in one form or another. Not popular debates, but debates between intellectuals, people trying to analyze it, people who refuse to go to the right. One thing that unifies all the contributors to this collection are none of them moved towards the right. They said, yeah, okay, it's a screw up, but there's a lot to fight for. And I think that is still the case, however bad times are, that one doesn't give up. Because what do you give up for? For a better world? No. And this also, I think, explains the hatred with which the media still treats anything mildly radical. It's much worse. The time when the Western media was actually more diverse and allowed more space to dissenting voices, and why books like this were published by mainstream houses, one reason for it was that they wanted to show the Soviet Union and the Eastern Europeans, look, this is what democracy means. Now they don't need to show anyone. Well, why should they bother allowing divergent dissenting voices? So you have I don't know whether some of you, I mean, The Economist, of course, symbolizes this. And you have these two economists, one in praise of Margaret Thatcher, and one cover with Hugo Chavez, this picture on the cover saying Chavez's rotten legacy. And the rotten legacy is what? That he was using state money to push through a sort of radical social democratic program. Even that is now unacceptable.
That was Tariq Ali speaking about his new book, The Stalinist Legacy, Its Impact on 20th Century World Politics.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.